Welcome, movie lovers, to Anatomy of Movie as we dissect Atomic Blonde, the new Charlize Theron movie. It takes place in the 80s when the Berlin Wall is falling, so stay tuned as we dissect all of it.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
Damn right we talk movies, and we're going to talk everything surrounding Atomic Blonde. But before we really dive in, and even before I introduce everyone, the Marissa Serafini's already dancing. I was going to call you the Marissa Serafini because that's your...
That is my name, yes.
The?
Hello,
everyone. The Marissa
Serafini. I'm the Marissa Serafini. Don't get it wrong.
So
get,
the
don't
is get your first name.
I'm
gotcha.
The Marissa Serafini. Yes. Hello, everyone. I'm back. I'm here.
And we have Dimitri Panos
hey,
as well.
Hey, how are you? Not the, just Dimitri. You take the off for savings.
Fair enough. And I'm Phil Svitek. Lovely to have you guys. For those of you just joining us for the very first time, welcome. If you're joining for another round, welcome back. We love you guys just the same. A couple things to note. We assume that you've seen the movie, so it will be spoiler-filled. Secondly... we have our rundown that's included in the description, so that way you get to follow along and see the finer details of what we're talking about. If you know, we don't always get to some of the stuff. You know, it's like an iceberg. Our research represents
an iceberg.
Well, it represents the depth of the stuff that we talk about. And in the booth, our great engineer Anthony. Anthony was also seen this and really wants to talk about the movie. Welcome, Anthony.
Hello, everybody. How's it going? Hope to have a wonderful discussion this evening.
Yes. How's Brady doing?
Oh, he's great. He's like laying down right next to me, just chilling. Yeah.
We're just bringing the whole family. Brady's the dog.
Brady's a dog.
All right. Now that you've met the whole cast and crew, including the dog, don't worry. We're going to make a lot of comparisons to John Wick. The dog does not get killed during this podcast.
Let's hope not.
I blame you, Anthony, if it happens.
Let's start with overall impressions. Marissa, let's start with you.
You know, I saw this trailer so many times, and I was really excited. Like, I love Charlize Theron. She's gorgeous. She's an amazing actress. Has a great career. So I was actually naturally really excited for this film. Watching it throughout, there was a lot of good fight scenes and some good action moments that you would find in a normal film, such as this. I found the predictability of this movie was very unfortunate. More so because a lot of times when I watch movies, I'm like, yeah, I was right, you know? And then at the end of this film, I was like, ugh, I was right. I knew it. Like, I literally predicted everything in the first 20 minutes, and then I had to watch the rest of the movie just to confirm my predictions, and I was more upset about it. And yeah, it was visually pretty sometimes here and there, but I just felt like the story kind of lacked for me personally. But there were other things that I really did enjoy about this film. Charlize was great. I mean, watch it for her, really.
Fair enough. Sure. Dimitri?
Yeah, I don't know. Atomic Blonde and or The Spy Who Went Into the Cold. The weather in the Cold War. You know, for me, this sort of kind of was a pleasant surprise. Like you, Marissa, it seemed like everywhere I go, or every movie that I went, I saw this trailer in one way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. So kudos to the Focus Exhibitor Relations Department who handles such things. So I was expecting more of a John Wick-ish kind of a movie, but I ended up getting a little more Jean Le Carré. So it's like Jean Le Carré mixed with some John Wick. Jean Le Carré being the spy author who did The Spy Who Came In From the Cold and the such, and did Smiley's People. Tinker Tailor Told Soldier Spy. These are Jean Le Carré. They're very talky types of spy movies and espionage and building suspense. And this one had that. I mean, we've got it's a Cold War spy movie. And while it does have some familiar trappings, Knocklist has gotten out, lists all the spies. Good guys need to get it back so it doesn't expose their spies. The bad guys want it, the Russians in this case, so that they can see who the spies are. And then you throw in this Satchel character, who's sort of a double agent spy. So again, we've seen this knock list device in other types of espionage kind of movies, but where I really think this movie excels, well, it's Charlize Theron. I mean, producing the movie, and here acting in this movie, and she gives us this MI6 operative, Lorraine Broughton, and you know, she can do as much with a stare as she can with a stiletto high heel. I mean, I thought that she was really great in this role. Yet another strong female lead, female character, who literally carries this movie and takes her punches. Boy, howdy, are there punches. I mean, fight scenes last long, and they're brutal. And you've almost to the point where you feel every knock, kick, and punch to the head, gut, and or back. I thought she was really, really good. But you can't keep a good woman down. Theron managed roughly 90% of her stunts, and I thought she was great. Atomic Blonde has a great thumping 80s soundtrack to help push it along. You know, I got to throw back, like, I think Guardians of the Galaxy sort of kind of brought this kind of soundtrack back, the first one. And, you know, where it made music very integral to the story and popular. And so now we have a great 80s soundtrack in this movie. And I think it really helps move the story along. It's a really fun soundtrack. However, they use the David Bowie song, Putting Out the Fire with Gasoline, which was the main song from the movie Cat People, with Natasha Kinski in it. I don't know of another movie that has repurposed what was the hit main theme song to another movie, and now they've used it in this movie as sort of kind of their theme song, in a sense. But we'll talk a little bit more about Bowie a little bit later on, but I love that song. Okay. And I loved it when it first came out, and it's a great song now.
Well, you know, a lot of people describe this movie as just like the 80s Pandora station, which in essence it can be. You know, and I don't know. You guys had mentioned that there's trailer after trailer for this movie, and the trailer is so cool. And so it sets you up to go into a cool movie. And I was expecting a really fun movie. And for them, you know, there's a lot there, but it doesn't go any deeper than that. It just plays by the book, very cliched. You know, if the only new thing is that, okay, we've got a female lead in this role, it's not cool enough. You still have to have a good story. And unfortunately, I would say if it had a male lead in it too, I'd say, okay, the story overall is just boring. No offense. I really want to see more movies with her as the character. Just give me a good storyline. Because I think there's a lot to take away from it. And unfortunately, to Marissa's point, I don't, you know, I want to, once we'll get into it pretty soon, but in terms of the reveal, I don't know if I predicted the reveal as much, but I also just didn't really care. There's a difference when you're watching The Usual Suspects. You're like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God.
Right.
This is like, wait, what? Huh? All right, fine. And that's it. And there's not that hit. There's not that gut check. There's not that moment of realization. It doesn't mean anything for the world, really. I don't get what the takeaway there really is. So anyway, unfortunately, I didn't have the best opinion of it. Anthony, I'll throw it to you, and then we'll dive deeper into the stuff we've been bringing up.
Yeah, there is a lot of things I can say where I agree with you guys. Like what you just said with the whole reveal, I definitely didn't feel it as much. Man, I'm thinking about it. I was like, why didn't I? And it's possible it just like I guess maybe the stakes weren't raised high enough for me to be like, oh man, these spy operatives are going to die. That's crazy. Because in reality, I didn't see any of their faces. Like, I didn't know any of these spy operatives, maybe because I couldn't sympathize with the potential dangers that the film set up for us. So I could agree there. Like, the reveal of her, like, working with the USA was like, oh, okay, like that's cool, I guess. Like, we see John, the final reveal where we see John Goodman, you know, just sitting on the plane. It's like, oh, all right, she was English. She was American the whole time. Like, all right.
Well, she was Satchel.
Yeah, she was Satchel too. Even then, that
well,
too,
not
I was
a
like,
Satchel too. She kinda, was Satchel. That
she was
Satchel
the
was.
Double agent.
Yeah, she was Satchel.
I'll sum it up real fast. It is an adaptation of a graphic novel from 2012, The Coldest City. It was a passion project as described for Theron. It took 5 years to get there, and here we are. Okay, great. So let's talk about it, and we'll talk about the writing in a little bit. But let's talk about what is it? What is it?
What
We're
is
there.
What?
The ending. What is the reveal? What's the takeaway like?
Well, I mean, for me, again, maybe I'll admit it. You know, I'm the idiot of the bunch. So I didn't see that she was Satchel. Probably until she was maybe meeting with John Goodman by the wall, by the Berlin Wall.
Getting that information,
and we know that Percival, the James McAvoy character, you know, he had looked at the list. He knew who Satchel is, you know. And this whole movie was going around. We need the list back, and we have to figure out who Satchel is because Satchel can undo us all. Satchel's a double agent, and I thought they were doing a good job. For me, anyways, for playing as to this Satchel character and who it could be, I knew right off the bat that it couldn't be Percival because it was just too easy. Mm. I mean, Percival, James McAvoy was great. I thought I really liked him a lot, but he was such a shit. I mean, he was he was playing all sides, and there was nothing you can trust about him. And for me, I was like going, "Well, that's not Satchel. It's just way too easy." For him to be Satchel. So it's somebody that we don't know yet. Could it be Sophia Boutella, who I also really liked in this movie? And I thought they did a really good job in doing this. And again, this is a Jean Le Carré kind of a story type. It's like there's a spy within the spy network that's spying on us. And so when we came to the end, and obviously, Percival has to die because he knows the truth. So when she gets on the private jet and John Goodman's there, I don't know. I was like, oh. Again, I didn't have the usual suspects. This is not the usual suspects. I didn't have that feeling. But I felt like, well, this is cool. And when he said to her, cocksucker, really? I thought that was funny. And I just bought it. I bought it hook, line, and stinker for you guys. I don't know. The ending didn't bother me.
Marissa, explain like what you had predicted as you're watching it, and then kind of take us through that thought process.
So when they talked about that there was a double agent, I was like, okay. Usually, if they want a big reveal, it's usually something that's always hiding, literally in plain sight under our noses. And I thought it could have been two people, Percival or her. Or Lorraine. I was like, it could be both, and it'd be great if it was Lorraine because, you know, you wouldn't expect it from your protagonist, or so to speak, or your main antagonist, which the film was, like, led up to maybe Percival as the main antagonist. It's like, it could be two people. And then when she killed Percival, I was like, okay, it has to be her, you know. But so at the early beginning part of the film, and they mentioned that this list is very important, and I think it was, like, granted, Charlize is a great actress, but I think it was the acting ability of her British accent, not to sound terrible because I can't do it either, was so bad that I couldn't believe that she was a British person, and it just sounded off for this character, to the point where I was like, she's no way is she actually British, knowing that, like, she actually isn't really? British in real life. But I felt like it didn't match with her character that she was that British. I was like, no, it'd be a great reveal if she was like, oh, psych, I'm not British, and then, like, there it was. So that was my mental thought process, that just her acting ability that she wasn't British enough gave it away for me.
It worked for me. There was much that didn't work for me when it came to Charlize Theron. I mean,
but they did make a conscious choice of the level of her, like when she's talking on at the bridge, and they're saying like they're talking about Langley and whatnot. She kind of starts slipping up back into an American accent, and that's a choice. It's not a mess up. It's a choice of acting to kind of throw that in there. The problem I have with it is that it's, you know, usually in something like this, you would suspect Percival, and then it would shift, and you'd be like, oh, wait, it wasn't him. He's a good guy. He's a good guy. He's still a little shitbag.
He is.
So, big shitbag.
So it's not like he's, for the most, he's still a double agent. He still wanted to sell the crap out of that thing.
And it's hard.
But come out a good guy by revealing who Satchel was.
Yeah, and the thing is, the way that I looked at the character of Percival was, it wasn't that he was a double agent. He didn't want the wall to go down because he had his fiefdom. Like, he created this world of buying and selling, and he was living off this, and he didn't care who he threw under a bus because, hey, look at the life that he was leading. I mean, he was going to nightclubs. He was known by people. He was like, screw the spy business, man. I can buy and sell all the... connections. And once Lorraine comes into this world, he's like, oh, shit. It's like, whoa, what am I going to do? And then you throw in Sophia Boutella's character, and then he's like, oh, my God, this is all about to come to a crashing end. And I knew something was up with him when he said he didn't know Charlize Theron's the spy at the beginning, who we see get killed. And then when he talks about him later, like, oh, yeah, we were really good friends. You're like, well, wait. Oh, he's lying to us. Then I thought, oh, Satchel. But then it was like, no, it's just way too easy. These movies aren't that easy. And then you feel, that guy's just a shitbag. He's just, I'm doing what I'm doing. I love what I do. People look at me, and I have power. I have control over people, and I can get them what they need, and I can sell it to the highest bidder. So he had that whole thing going, but he was just a bad person.
The problem, you know, to expand upon my thing, and then Anthony can give your take of this, or anyone can really jump in, but, you know, whether it's The Usual Suspects, or I'm trying to think of another movie I just had one in mind, but I lost it.
Sixth Sense, maybe?
Nah, it has to be, like, kind of something spy-y. You know, we applaud it for the action. I mean, you know, we'll talk about the sequence and whatnot, which I thought, to be honest, was a little overlong. I think they could have cut down a lot of these action scenes and, like, let's stick to story, and that's part of the problem. But anyway, I digress. The matter of the fact being, when she's telling her story, recounting it, she's supposed to be telling a lie. But there's a weird distinction. Like, they tell some of the truth, and they also tell some of the lie. And so it becomes weird because you got to stick to you got to be like an amazing magician in that and have that craft to continue the lie as truthful as it is, and so that way, you know, when things unwrap by the end, that's when the truth is revealed, and like all these names, you know, that's when the camera goes of like, okay, hey, she said this, but that was a made-up name that she read on this business card that didn't make sense, or this person, you know, like the fact that she cut the tapes.
She edited the tape, yeah.
Yeah, that's supposed to be a reveal. Like, it's, in a weird way, it's like she's telling the people, and yet, no, that's the lie behind what she's saying, and you're slightly left confused.
Yeah, but see, I got, like, the editing of the tape. You really saw that at the end of the movie when the reveal, like, I got this as, like, to your point, when she kills Percival, then you're like, could she potentially be Satchel? And then when you're, then it's like that next plot point of, then you see her doing stuff. It's like, well, we saw her in that room earlier in the movie, but I didn't know she was editing tape. And then now we see her editing tape. And again, my one thing I was wondering, do people actually know what she's doing? Like, because that doesn't exist today at all. I mean,
not
I knew,
that antiquated version.
It's a very antiquated version. But I thought that it was, I go, oh, she took all his soundbite and she's making him, that she's Satchel. So when she walks on the plane, the reveal is already there for us. I just like the John Goodman character, I guess. I don't know. I liked how it played out in that very in the finality of the third act.
And then you sound like you want to jump in.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that whole her editing the tape sequence as well at the end. I have a feeling like if they did somewhat of a better job kind of leaving breadcrumbs for us to follow, but at the same time leave them very vague, as in like, oh, what's she doing in this scene? And like, why did they show us this? Why did that just happen? There was none of that until the very reveal. And that's what kind of made it like, oh, okay. Like, it felt flat. It felt really flat. If it was sprinkled throughout the film, like just random shots of her doing the work as Satchel, I think it would have worked much better for the reveal.
I think this is where I think Marissa's going to agree with me, and so feel free to jump in. But I think just the sheer length of it, and especially the action stuff, you're so exhausted that you've kind of forgotten the story. And I think had it been tighter, we would have gotten some of the clues. Because I think on a page level, like bullet point, like they have enough clues laid in. But you just forget.
I can understand. We'll definitely get to the action moments. But I felt that there were enough moments throughout the film where she's purposely withholding information from the people who she's recanting the story to and to the audience herself. And that was like a red flag for me. I was like, oh, she's hiding information that no one wants to know. She's protecting herself.
Right.
And that was also another indication where that's where I thought, oh, she could be the double agent. I think there were multiple moments where I picked that up.
Yeah, I never thought that myself, to be honest. So that's actually a pretty good point.
I did get that she was withholding information, but I'm trying to wonder, was that to protect herself from, like, implicating herself with that gentleman at the beginning, implicating herself with Sofia Boutella's character? And I didn't know exactly. She was protecting someone. And then it just comes out she was actually protecting herself. And remember, she's supposed to be she's supposed to be an MI6 agent. Now, MI6 is made famous by James Bond. He's an MI6 licensed to kill agent, and this is what she gets called in for, to testify, so to speak. And M is the guy behind the double pane, the mirrored glass. But I agree with you, Marissa. I thought, too, that she was withholding information, but I didn't know if that was to protect somebody else. Maybe I'm just a dunce. I didn't figure out the Satchel aspect until the director wanted me to know that she was actually Satchel. And that wasn't her getting on the plane, but it was that third act.
I don't think you're necessarily wrong. I think a couple of things for me. Number one, we didn't have a clear sense of why are we recounting the story? What is the end result and why are we here? Number one, it's a dicey thing because, again, maybe if you over-explain of that result, then we figure out the trickery. But we need something more than we were given, I think. Number two, there's a lot of people I think this is a very confusing movie because from what I've been reading, a lot of people are asking a lot of questions. Some even have I don't think it's necessarily a wrong interpretation. I think it's slightly misinformed, but they thought Percival was Satchel and then she just took on his identity. So I don't think that's necessarily a bad reading of it either based on like how confusing some of this stuff is.
Yeah, I mean...
Well, I think mostly, me personally, I think I just put two and two together really quickly, it sounds like it. But I personally tend to follow stories that have multiple characters, and you kind of develop this skill of knowing like who's important and who's not. And I think that's what they tried to do with this film. They kept adding more guys that could potentially be the suspect, could potentially be the double agent. And then once they start dying one by one, I was like, it is kind of like the last man standing has to be that person. But they kept adding these guys, and then they kept dying every once in a while. I was like, okay, it's probably her.
Yeah, and again, I'll just go back to Jean Le Carré. I mean, that subterfuge of confusing an audience, that's part of the crux of a lot of his. Just to put a little bit into perspective, too, Jean Le Carré was an actual agent, okay, the author here. He was an actual agent, and he was writing to be the antithesis of James Bond. James Bond was very popular, right? But James Bond, for me and Fleming, is very escapism, okay? He has this very lush life, travels. where Le Carre knew it's really not that glamorous and it could be very dangerous. And so those movies, if you watch Spy Who Came In From the Cold, or even Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, there's so many characters in there and there's a lot of dialogue, right? But you again, that's trying to find a mole as well. And that's what I sort of kind of appreciated about this. Not that it was as layered as a Le Carre, but we get a little more dialogue. This wasn't a John Wick movie, even though we had the fight scenes. There was a little bit more. It was a little more Cold War spy movie, which we haven't had in an extremely long time.
Especially like with this female lead.
We've never had. Never. You're right. We've never had that. And I sort of kind of appreciated the fact that I was a little bit confused, that I had to pay attention, that I had to look at things. So if I go in with the second viewing, knowing what I know, I do believe there were breadcrumbs dropped throughout that could sort of signify that she too is Satchel. And you got to remember, as MI6, she's covering up the fact that she is Satchel, and she knows that information is out there. And the reason why they were interrogating her is, from the MI6 perspective, it was a botched job. They never really got this knock list. Like, a lot of people died, including the person that they were supposed to be getting out of West Berlin into East Berlin. Was that it? West to East?
Yeah.
He gets killed. There's a lot of carnage. A lot of people got killed. She's the last one standing, and I'm not even quite sure. The only information that she really had was Satchel. She had the list, but
even that, the exposition could have been so compressed of, like, you know, she comes in, you botched that job. We told you to get the list, and we told you to figure out who Satchel was. What the hell happened?
But they did. I mean, it wasn't as blatant. It wasn't as blatant as you just put it. But they did say, "But you're here because of, like, what the hell happened to Berlin."
But I know. But you gotta
recount our story.
You know, you gotta mask exposition as ammunition, and now's the time to just get it out.
Okay.
Rather than because they say that, but then she recounts the story of, like, well, you met. You told me to do this. And it just, it drags.
Okay.
I don't know. It does for me.
I mean, I can kind of agree with that, too. I felt like it dragged because they kept adding more and more characters that eventually died off later. And I think that's why a lot of people might have gotten confused, unless that was for artistic purposes to throw people off, was that they kept adding more people to make us think it could be this person, could be this one. And that's where the story gets convoluted, because now we're spending so much time on other people away from her,
right,
that we were led to believe it could be them.
Yeah, and I again, just going under and knowing that the screenwriter and the director even have gone on to say, like, I just took it that was their homage, like, to... Let's make this a convoluted, because Le Carre, did you ever watch Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy?
I did, and I liked that. It's a very different,
slow burn, right? It's different because, well, it doesn't have the action that this movie has in it, right? But it is different, but there are the moles in this, and we have great performances in that movie. I just found this sort of kind of playing homage to that style, and hey, why don't we try to have the best of both worlds? We're going to have a female, or three worlds, female character, who's, I thought she was fantastic. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to have some fight scenes and some actions that today's audience is used to. And then I'm going to throw in, like, some convoluted espionage. Well, so, and obviously it didn't work for you.
Well, I'll give them this, and sorry, that. You know, I don't mean to be like a Monday morning quarterback in this. But I thought some of the stuff that really did work was, for example, when they had the sex scene, they cut to, like, so you made contact with the operative? Yes. I thought that was funny because we're juxtaposing that. I thought, for no offense, for some of the longer stuff, especially when you're recounting a story, how much of this detail are you freaking recounting? Like, just be like, okay, so you fought a lot of people? Yeah, I fought a lot of people. Okay, great. And cut, and we're good. Because part of it is, I don't know, I want to get from your guys' perspective, how much of this A is true? Because that's what I'm unclear on. Like, she could have shot the guy that she was protecting. She could have shot him. And we just never seen it. She made up, obviously, this elaborate thing. And the other part of it is, from a movie perspective, if you're recounting a story, the fact that we go to Percival as a third person while she's recounting the story, it's supposed to be from her perspective. How the hell would she know any of that?
No, I thought the same way.
So the filmic language is a little incongruent.
But don't forget who she set up to be the patsy. It was Percival.
Yeah, but how
And I don't think that she shot Eddie Marsden's character. I don't think she was shooting... I don't think she shot the defect... Well, actually...
It's to her benefit to have him die.
Yeah, that's true, too.
No, I thought the same way, too, because there were moments where there were only scenes where Percival was by himself. And I had the exact same thought. I was like, how would she know this is what Percival was doing? Like, right. This is who Percival saw, you know, at night by himself, X, Y, and Z. I mean, right. We get the photo reveals. But again, how much of it is actually fabricated and how much actually happened.
Right.
And I think we were talking about styles when it came to, yeah, she could have just shot him or shot all these people and then the action scene would be over. And I think that's where this movie kind of also suffers, where they focus too much on the stylistic aspect and then lost the story and substance.
The Eddie Marsden character was going to die. And I think once his family, once that character's family was introduced, okay, and here's, and I'm just going off of what I believe. She may have been wanting to kill that character, right? We'll call him the defector. I forget his name. And
I'll find it, but keep going.
But he's the defector.
Spyglass.
Spyglass. Yeah. Okay, so Spyglass, we learn, has a photographic memory. He knows the list by heart. Okay. And, yeah, she could have shot him. Her plan may have been to have killed him during this escape, but then the family is brought into it. And she's like, this wasn't part of the plan. And she sees that he has a family, and I believe that...
Now she grows a conscience?
Yeah.
Well... She has to protect... You gotta understand, it's not necessarily about now she grows a conscience, okay? She's like, this is much larger because this guy's got a family. I'm an American spy, okay? I'm part of the CIA, all right? I've got to protect my cover, this cover. Now I know that this guy has a family. Well, she could save him and bring him to the U.S. and bring the entire family to the U.S. That wasn't uncommon during that time either, and that would fit well into a spy thing. As far as our Percival character goes, he didn't want him to go out because he wanted to be sole keeper of all the information, and yet this guy now can go sell it out because he's got this photographic memory. It's the photographic memory that's a plot point here that keeps this story going. And so he wants him dead because he does know the list, and he's somebody else that's, well, if he knows it, somebody else can extract him and get the same information that he's going to get. So I get why he wants to shoot him, but in the end, does Lorraine Broughton really try that hard to unstrap him?
No.
My problem with Spyglass was that they built him up just because he's so important. If his information gets out, then, you know,
right.
Her information got out. But my problem is, once Spyglass was actually killed, I didn't feel sorry for him. I'm sorry, that sounds terrible. But, like, I didn't care, more so. And, like, yeah, unfortunately, his family was not there. It's more of a, like Anthony was saying, a more of a sympathetic person.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't care because it was just another person to eliminate. I was like, all right, move on. It's not him.
I just, a couple plot points or questions certainly arise for me the more we talk about it. Number one, why wouldn't you just write it back? The guy's got a photographic memory. Great, we're going to get you safely across. Just write down your names. Let's figure this out so we have some sort of backup in writing. Number one. Number two, you know, I question what this guy ultimately knows and kind of what his involvement is, because if he knows the list... And based on the list, Percival was able to figure out that satchel is her. You know, how does he not figure it out? Again, I'm not saying that it has to be 100%. Like,
wasn't she using an alias of Lorraine?
Yeah.
So, she might have been able to pull the fast one on him, except for Percival, who was able I don't know, to be able to go more in depth with it, or I don't know how he figured it out. But.
Percival has street smarts. I mean, he don't forget, he was an, well, technically, he was still an MI6 operative who just went off the rails. So he was no dummy. He was just, he just knew, he just took his smarts to play every side so that it was to his benefit, and he can do that in Berlin because it was easy. It was easy pickings for him, and he didn't care to be part of the establishment or MI6. So I think to your point, Anthony, is that, yeah, I think Percival was smart enough to, he could figure out that list pretty easily, I feel, because he was no dummy.
And it could be to the point where Spyglass probably did know Lorraine's identity, but because he was in the position that he was in, he was so afraid for his life and for his family. Maybe he was also protecting himself and not revealing the fact that he knew.
Yeah.
More so just to try to cross the border.
Yeah, he might have just not known. They might have just been names to him.
Yeah.
And he had no idea who these names were, because wasn't he what was he, like an accountant? He wasn't a spy per se. Spyglass. I forget.
Again, it just raises so many questions that I think if something like this, like, it should have a singular question: who is Satchel? Boom, we're trying to figure out that. You thought this person was Satchel? It's not. But there's just too many angles of which are open ended.
Right.
That I just don't like it.
It made your head spin. I get it.
See, I
understand.
Yeah, I think the problem with Spyglass is that I think the way he was portrayed is that he was just an unfortunate guy who knew too much information. And he was in the wrong place, the wrong time, and he just got caught up in the mess, and unfortunately was just stuck in the middle.
Yeah, he wanted freedom. And the only way, these people assured him freedom and safety. And he had this information. And he was going to obtain freedom and get to the other side of the wall. And that's another aspect of this movie that I really enjoyed, because all of this is happening on the eve of the breaking down of the wall, which is a really big deal. So freedom was going to be obtained, you know, the hope of it happening loomed, and you definitely saw the different sides of the wall, you know, and how West Berlin really did differ from East Berlin. And I appreciated that. I appreciated that they set this in the 80s, because that was it was a crazy time. There was a Cold War going on that it sort of almost feels like we're almost going back into again, but that wall represented so much to so many people for so many different reasons, including the United States of America. I don't know. I got wrapped up into it all.
I got lost in the forest.
I get it. No, I hear you. And you know what?
Part of it's I get it. The spy. I love, you know, the spy game, the headiness of it all. But we're essentially, you know, the Americans were basically like, okay, well, whatever. We're going to, in order to protect us, to gain information, we'll F over the Brits if we needed. That was their buffer.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's, I don't know how the UK feels about this movie. I don't know. That song, London Calling, yeah, they might be.
Yeah. Who doesn't love Charlize?
That's a great song. I think maybe I'm used to Agatha Christie style. You're making all these other references, but sure. I think Agatha Christie does a great job of setting up a mystery. It's this one person, but there's 20 people, less, you know, deduce everything, and with all the information we know, and literally take out people one by one until you get the last person standing. That's usually how it is. And I think this film kind of had that same style, that same approach, where there's so many people who could be the person, and then we clearly kill them off one by one.
There were a lot of MacGuffins in this movie, for sure. You know, I mean, Sophia Boutella's character, you know, she could have been called Femme Fatale MacGuffin. That's her name. She has a first name, a middle name, and a last name. You know, she was French and Irish.
what I appreciate...
Ethnically ambiguous.
In doing kind of research around this, and what I appreciated was the honesty behind it. Like, to be honest, and this is a scary thought, a lot of the agents that they picked, certainly in terms of the Brits, you know, were broken down, alcoholic type people that were, because they were expendable. And generally, by the age of 40, like, most people didn't really live past the age of 40. Either they died, or to be honest, they took their own life. So they were no longer a liability with their guilt of over, like, all the crap that they knew.
Right.
So that portrayal of whether Percival or even Delphine was fairly accurate, mm-hmm. but just in the it got lost in the muddle of this movie. And I you know, so when you make the point of Percival was really acting on his behalf, he wasn't necessarily a double agent. He was playing both sides, but you know, the way you're describing is more of that versus self-interest versus a double agent. Mm-hmm. He could give a F.
Well, yeah, to me it was self-interest because he had had it with MI6. And he had power in the world that he was living in. He could use his skill to better his life. And in Berlin at that time period, he, you know, in his mind, he was having a pretty damn good life. He can go to clubs. He knew all the, he knew the underground. He knew the upper ground. He knew high society and he knew the low society. And all for him, he was just a broker of information. And he could play it like, oh, is your MI6? Oh, yeah, well, you can trust me. I'm your ally here. And he played, again, to James McAvoy's credit, I thought he was fun to watch, as much of a shitbag as he was. And you really wanted him to get his comeuppance, because you just hated him, threw everybody under the bus. But
he was, but she needed to paint him. If she's recounting the story, she needed to paint him in a, you know, a less self-interest model. Like,
I thought she painted him as a crazy guy. Because he was a little crazy.
Go ahead, Anthony.
I mean, one of the things that I think the film was trying to do was frame Percival right off the bat as, like, again, like a shitbag, someone not to be trusted, someone that you're not supposed to sympathize, someone that you're supposed to... It's like a red herring to make you assume that this is going to be Satchel. And again, the whole film is framed through Charlize Theron's character, and by doing so really sets him up to be the bad guy and everything, and so he's like really misunderstood when in reality he's actually working for MI6 like through and through, while Charlize Theron is the double agent working for the USA playing MI6 and also the KGB.
And don't forget, the story is coming from her perspective.
Yeah,
she has complete control.
For all we know, this could all be wrong. Yeah,
right, she's the one who's recounting everything.
Okay, just for my clarity, right? Because I'm getting so lost in the details. Satchel, it known that it was a British agent?
I don't think
it's a double agent.
We just know it's a double agent.
I don't think the film ever specifies what side Satchel was playing on.
Right.
Okay, well, because only by that fact. You know, when like if I was to recount like recount the story and try to lie to the superiors in that way, we're really kind of it's between the French, Delphine, and Percival. Like, who else are you kind of really left with on the menu?
The people in Berlin, the Russians.
The Russians are double agents towards the Brit. How does that work?
But it was all about trying to get this information. Now, England. MI6 knew there was a double agent. French knew there was a double agent. Obviously, the CIA knows that there's a double agent. Mm-hmm. That could. They were brought in because this could potentially blow up in America's face as well. We got to find out who the Satchel is, and we've got to protect our own, because the CIA was also there because they believed some of their agents' names were on this knock list. Right, yeah. And everything was going to be revealed by this list. And again, I think we've seen this in Bourne movies and stuff.
Yeah, like multiple parties are affected by this.
Yeah, by this one list. So it went above and beyond just being Satchel. It's if this list was going out to the highest bidder. So if it gets into the Kremlin's hands, that's not good, because then they have MI6 agents, they have CIA agents, and they can know who the double agents is. They run the table. So that's why there was the importance of this information and getting it and getting it back. Satchel, to me, was almost, while it became a main thing, it was almost, to an extent, like, for me anyways, at the beginning anyways, it was a little bit secondary, who is the satchel person? And to your point, they kept on knocking people off or making it too easy. And I will say that I think that it was Sophia Boutella's character.
Delphine.
I actually believe that aspect of the story was true. And Charlize, Lorraine didn't expand on her relationship with Delphine. But I actually think that she saw a little bit of herself when she was a young spy. And that's what I liked about Delphine, because she even says, her own admission, I got into this because I thought this was going to be exciting. I got into this because maybe she thought she was going to be like a James Bond. But there are higher stakes than the glamour of it all. And she was a little bit naive. And that's why she's like, you know, you didn't have to.
She's a lot naive.
Yeah. You didn't have to kill her. You know, there was no reason for her to die. And I actually believe that's one aspect of the story that's true. I believe that Lorraine Broden, or Satchel, really cared for this Delphine character. I felt.
In thinking about it, I don't know. I've just been to too many meetings with higher-ups that they're... if you have, quote, this tape that's evidence of who Satchel is, my first question would be, did you get the list? Do you know who Satchel is? No, I didn't get the list, but I know who Satchel is. That's where the conversation would start. And then be like, okay, great. Who the hell's Satchel? All right, well, how are they? Now explain it to me. And why the hell don't you have the list? Still could work as a story. Mm-hmm. Like... It's just the narrative of it all isn't fitting.
But she had to explain her cock up too. You know, I mean, the thing went south very quick. The defector didn't defect. He got killed. A lot of dead bodies. There was a lot of attention that ended up being paid to MI6 doesn't want this attention, the CIA doesn't want this attention. And in trying to cover up her tracks, there's a lot of attention being thrown. This Percival character, who was an MI6 agent, was bringing attention just by going rogue, and we have to try to rein him in, and then he's going off the rails. So to me, that's the way I was looking. They were interrogating her to say, what the hell happened? Well, how could this have gone so south? Yeah, you accomplished your mission, but... Man,
it was messy.
It was really messy. What did you do?
She didn't get the list. She didn't accomplish them. I guess if I'm saying anything, it would have played to me, I think, better just linear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It actually would have been to its advantage.
Yeah.
I think.
I completely agree, but, you know, I love non-linear stories, so I think another reason why I could follow along a little bit more for the predictability's sake. But I agree. It was like the narrative was all over the place, and we were spending so much time and so many different people, and I felt like there were some characters they were trying to build up, like Spyglass had a family to take care of. Delphine was like new to this industry. Like new to this world. Yeah, like new to this world, but like she's getting swept up with it. Like I feel like this is where they try to actually build characters, but it was a little too much for people that we couldn't follow along. Therefore, we're not... and then once they actually died, you're like, well, shoot, why did we spend so much time with them if there was no payoff?
Yeah.
And I think that's what was more frustrating.
I hear you.
Speaking of frustrating, I'm trying to figure out where to even go from here.
Well, I mean...
I feel like we've been spinning our wheels. Yeah,
let's highlight the good stuff.
I wanted to talk about the screenwriting. I do want to talk about the action, but, you know, like... Look, screenwriter Kurt Johnstead, he was approached to pen the script as an adaptation of the graphic novel that you so quickly glossed over.
I just had to get – everyone was dying to get in, so I was like, all right, let me read this at 100 miles an hour.
This is where it came from.
I'm glad he didn't hit a speed bump. His father, believe it or not, was a pilot for Pan Am. And he was based in West Berlin during the 60s and then again in the 80s. So he got to spend a lot of time there before the wall fell. So creatively, and again, I agree, it was a powerful place to be in. The art, the music scenes were thriving. But he also noticed how it felt to be an outpost where danger was lurking. And he wanted to try to convey that heightened sense of peril. So, and I think for the most part, you know, we definitely got, like I said, the dichotomy between East and West, you know, and as far as a graphic novel, I've not read it. I guess it's a monochromatic or black and white graphic novel, but Theron's team saw the opportunity to take a story that is relentless and committed, as well as tough and fun and sexy, and explore it fearlessly on screen. So, you know, it was Theron who actually championed this, and she brought it into her production house. And I give her so much credit, you know, coming up with, she produces this, she knows she's going to act in it. She really is behind this movie a lot.
And she really liked John Wick.
Yeah, right. And she got to train with those trainers and stuff. We have a great training piece action video thing, but leading independent film finance and production entity, Sierra Affinity. Nick Mayer, who actually worked with at Lionsgate, he always gets confused with Nicholas Mayer, the director who did Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan. This guy, poor guy. They'll have an article of him, but they put the other Nick Mayer's picture up. But Nick Mayer and Mark Schaeberg financed, produced the film, licensed the rights to Focus Features in Universal from much of the world, as well as select high-end independent distributors. So what makes Atomic Blonde so viable is a strong female protagonist, played by Oscar winner Charlize Theron. Mm-hmm. And Theron, and I agree. In today's world, nothing could be truer. And to Charlize's credit, she jumped in with both feet. Like, producer, I'm going to do this. I'm going to work at it. And I can't fault her.
I think they just bit off more than they could chew. Like, you know, I think if the goal was to tell a really cool movie or show a really cool movie, for the director, it's to kind of highlight the culmination of his, because we haven't really talked about him, but his background's in stunt work, whether the Matrix Revolutions.
David Leitch, yeah.
Yeah. And he's worked with Chad, they directed John Wick 1 together, although he doesn't get credit thanks to the DGA. Then he gets hired for this, so he leaves John Wick 2 to do this. So he knows his stunts, and he's trying to highlight that. But I think, in some sense, for my money, it gets too muddled in people's own agendas, and in that respect, unfortunately.
Okay.
But let's. But again, I can't discredit the passion towards it. Like, let's bring up that video in terms of the training.
Sure.
Charlize Theron. I take nothing away from her.
This is actually, this is a cool amazing video. Yeah, she is.
So here we go.
The thing that I connected with Lorraine, was the fact that you feel everything.
She's in the top 1 percentile of actors to do their own action.
She's badass. At first, not knowing her skill level, we were going to break things down, do 3 or 4 moves, then cut. Move the camera over here, couple moves, cut. But then when we saw her abilities, that really lit the light bulb for us of like, we've got something special here, let's try to push this.
That's it.
So I changed the directives to the choreography team to like go big and build it out, and we'll do longer takes and we'll do more complex moves, because she could do 20 moves without cutting.
I had incredible teachers who were incredibly patient with me.
She would train with different martial arts drills.
Right from the beginning, it was very clear the way I was gonna fight, how a woman would really be able to fight and not break every bone in her fist.
Because she's a woman and she's fighting men, if they use one hand, she would use two. Or if they try to throw a punch, she would throw three. Or use the environment around her to gain an advantage.
It was really intense.
I can do that.
The stunt guys took so many hits. I had to buy a lot of alcohol to be forgiven, but there were no injuries. There were absolutely nothing. Or so they told me. So I don't know. Maybe they went home and cried.
I chose this life, and someday it's going to get me killed. But not today.
Yeah. That's a cool piece. Yeah, she is. That scene in the bathtub with all the ice. She's getting out, and I'm like, I was like saying to myself, are those actual bruises, maybe? How much makeup is involved? Because it really looked as if everybody took some hits.
Well, she did. Not because of a taking hit, but she had her jaw clenched, and she had to get two teeth kind of repaired from the process. So, you know.
Suffer for your art.
And by the way, her and Keanu Reeves did train, as we made mention, but they got really competitive, which I appreciate, which I think, you know, it's a weird kind of interesting, you know, because Chad and David both worked on Matrix Revolution, so I think they benefited from the idea of long takes and so forth. And Keanu, through those movies, benefits from learning martial arts. And so if he's having to push Charlize through this, she's going to be at a very high level.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's awesome when, I mean, Charlize, like, she's a great actress and she's a great fighter. Don't ever freaking mess with her. I really like that, and it speaks, you know, so many different things when they change a movie's style because of her style.
Right.
And I think that's where this film actually, you know, succeeds in the stylistic aspect. Visually, it was awesome to watch. Everyone loves a good fight scene, you know, and especially when you feel all the punches and the hits and the kicks. And girl has legs for days, so yeah, she kicked a lot. It's fun to watch, and I think it's really cool when it shows, like, she is a strong character and she's a physical strength. You know, like, she's literally a strong character.
Yeah.
And I think that's very intriguing to watch on screen.
Yeah, and the movie goes at great lengths that outside of you being shot in the head or whatever, you know, people don't die easily.
No.
They die hard, pretty much. And to an extent, I found, you know, we've talked about John Wick, and not that I hate the John Wick movies, but there is a definite pattern to the violence, you know? One in the chest, two in the head. One in the chest, two in the head. And I'm not going to, you know, I won't underplay Keanu's physical prowess and ability, because those fight scenes, too, are pretty exciting. They don't go to the lengths that I think Atomic Blonde does. Atomic Blonde, like, it just reminds... All I kept on thinking was there's a fight scene in this John Carpenter movie called They Live between Roddy Piper and David Keith, right?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's a grueling, and it lasts for like about 15 minutes.
Yeah, it's so surreal.
And by the time that the fight's over, even both the characters are like, huh, okay. And in this movie, I got the same sense. Like, when she gets slammed up against that wall, both the characters in this movie are having a hard time just getting up.
And she gets thrown down the stairs.
She gets thrown down
the stairs. A full flight of stairs several times.
And then there's a car chase. So, and it looked as if it were one take. That scene
to me was clearly terrible.
Right. The way it was choreographed, put together, I thought it was really solid. In An Action of Summer, I felt that it was, for me, it was at least original. In major part because of Charlize and that.
I agree. I just, you know, I'll go back to the point of at what cost. That's all. At what cost? But I, you know, I did, you know, I loved it in smaller doses. Like at the when she goes to the apartment and she's checking it out and you know, she's sort of found. I liked that action scene because I felt it was just long enough, but not too long.
Right.
Versus, you know, if I'm just watching the standalone bit, and by the way, I do think there's a video, someone's mentioned, I haven't found it yet, but someone's writing about it, where there's a whole video of the actual 10-minute sequence, which I'm surprised that they kind of let out, where David is actually talking about it and really breaking it down.
Oh, okay.
So it's interesting to me that they would allow that footage to sort of not leak, but like even just release it.
Well, don't forget, too, with John Wick, I think that's what helped perpetuate some of the popularity of John Wick. They released a lot of that stuff of Keanu training, whether it be...
Well, I'm talking about the actual sequence.
Well, but they did a little bit of that, too, you know, with Wick and showing and giving away, let's call it the magic. And that's how we got, wow, Like, that's how you see, holy cow, Keanu Reeves is really doing that. That I think that draws people in. And when you see, oh my God, Charlize Theron is really doing that. This is how this was filmed. Oh my head, that's amazing. You know, from a promo standpoint, from a marketing standpoint, I think it's a good idea. Both of you brought up some good points, though. And in a sense, the marketing, and I know I'm a little bit ahead of ourselves here, but it was a double-edged sword because it was almost a bait and switch. This movie really made it look more John Wick-ish.
No.
Than we get. Not that the action that we saw in the trailers was in the movie. I mean, it was all in the movie. But I was like, there was one scene in particular, like, that they showed a lot of, but they intercut it with other scenes, but it's the scene where she takes the gun out of the ice cube bucket.
Right.
You know, and I was
when
like,
that's the beginning of the trailer.
And I'm like going, when's that scene going to come in? Like, when's that scene going to happen? Oh, it's at the end of the movie, you know, but it's no less a great scene. She was,
but
was
I think
awesome. But I think it was a little bit of a bait and switch.
Yeah.
Like, a little.
I agree. If we're talking about the trailer, I saw the trailer so many times. I feel this is one of those moments where the trailer literally showed the whole movie, because if you take the action out of this film, what else do you have?
A lot of dialogue.
A very convoluted story that no one can follow.
And Stolian smoking.
Stolian
smoking. Yes. I actually counted how many times we saw drinks. I couldn't count, like, the cigarettes. But, like, I counted anywhere from 5 to 6 glasses of her just drinking.
What's the initial guy's name? Like, Stago? Whatever his name is. Spyglass, Smoking, and Stoli. That's the name of this movie. That's what it should be called.
So, just going back to Charlize Theron, I know that she used some of her ballet training for the fighting, which is seen. She gets a leg up on everybody.
It's choreography.
Some good choreography. And she did begin training less than 2 months out from Mad Max Fury Road, too. Mm-hmm. Another action movie that she's in. I don't know if there's anything, if there's much she can't do, from winning an Oscar, being in Monster. We talked about her, and I thought she was very special and funny in A Million Ways to Die in the West. She could be in Matt. Yeah, she was really good. She's
also
funny.
Like another film that a lot of people might not remember, Aeon Flux.
Aeon Flux.
That was an action movie. She did fight a lot in that too.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And she could do comedy. She can very much do drama. And I really felt that in this movie, she, again, I'm not kidding, I really felt that with a stare, you can tell that she was either working things out or she was feeling empathy or sympathetic. Like whenever she had her scenes with Sophia Boutella's Delphine's character, I really felt that she really wanted to take her under her wing. She wanted to protect her because of her naivete. And again, it wasn't by dialogue. I just felt it was more by expression. And I thought that, and again, that to me is fresh in a kind of movie this way, that you don't have a female character as the lead, and you have a female character who actually can emote. And that, to me, was important. I bought that she could do that very well.
But doesn't, you know, like, even from the perspective of you're recounting this, why would you recount, like, oh, this is the girl I love? Because they brought that into question of, like, I was just using her to figure out information. So why are you recounting more? If you're not recounting it, why the hell we watch it? Like, it's just that incongruence of, well, why?
Yeah, and people have been questioning, you know, this particular relationship between Delphine and Lorraine. And I was trying to justify it myself. So several different things came up to mind that it shows that Delphine's probably the only person that actually allowed Lorraine to be as closest to human as human as possible. Like, she can emote, she can have feelings, she can be sympathetic, she can actually get, you know, a real person without lying to anyone and actually speaking the truth. Like, she's most comfortable when she's doing, like, by herself in that sense, and she can maybe trust someone. Yeah, I felt like Delphine showed the humanity within Lorraine.
I
while
agree.
She's being swept up in this mad world with all these other, you know, agents that she's dealing with and people. But also, people are also saying this was gratuitous. I did think it was a little bit gratuitous, you know, the lovemaking. I was like, yeah, visually it's stunning for people who enjoy that. But also, was it necessary, especially because we see this relationship is building up for her to get information out of her? And Charlize Theron even says in interviews, like, she liked this relationship because it explored the idea that Lorraine is willing to go to any lengths to get whatever information. That's how dedicated she was to being an agent. It's like, all right, I get that, knowing that fact. But also, with the death of Delphine at the end, by the time we got the information, the little snippets that she finally got, it felt like it was information the audience already knew. Therefore, when Delphine died, you're like, okay, we knew that already. Sucks. I'm sorry.
Well, maybe in the trailer, but I don't know. I didn't find it gratuitous. Not because it was girl-on-girl action. This is a rated R movie, okay? This is a rated R adult movie. Like, I have no problem. I didn't find that it pushed the envelope. There was a hell of a lot more, say, in a movie like Showgirls, which came out many years before. I didn't find it gratuitous. I was surprised as to it sort of worked. Like, I didn't scoff at it. I didn't believe in it. And I thought it really did build a relationship. I agree with you, and just seeing what I had said earlier, this was the one true thing in her life that she actually sort of felt for. That was a truth that she obviously had hid from her superiors at MI6 and telling her story. But I actually felt that that was one true thing, and that she was really bummed out when Percival kills her, and she even says, you know, there was no reason. You didn't have to kill her. Like, you didn't have to. That was just mean. Like, that was mean.
Technically, you did.
But she didn't have any information.
Yes, she did. She had photos.
The photos
later on
of
that
of
she found.
Yeah.
Of him. And so he was trying to kill her so he could then sell the list and be like, hey, she was Satchel.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So
he had every motive to kill her.
Yeah. He didn't have. But to me, I don't know.
You're the spy.
What I was saying, I was more upset with this relationship because it didn't have a big enough payoff at the end.
So, well, and going to the sex scene, number one, it almost didn't happen originally planned. Long story short, she was originally a male character. They just changed in the graphic novel. Lorraine is shown seducing him. But you don't see any of the sex. And I think it's cool. And they did a gender flip. And Theron was like, sure, that's fine. Why not? We'll build this up. And I actually think it makes... If it were a male character, maybe you wouldn't sympathize as much. And I think that the way Sofia Boutella played Delphine...
She
did have an innocence to
definitely.
Her.
Definitely. She was the, you know... She was the fresh green... person in all of this. I think it was more so that I think I mentioned this on another Popcorn Talk show, Action Movie Anatomy, so plug them as well because they cover this film. I felt like it. I don't mind Sofia Boutella's at all. I like the fact that if you didn't have Delphine, what other woman do you have in this film other than Lorraine? This is a sausage fest movie, and so I'm
the
glad
wife.
The
one
I'm just saying.
No.
Boom.
Okay. But who said what?
Nothing. I'm just
like, what line does she have? Exactly. There isn't, other than like Lorraine was a great lead. Love, and I'm all about female, you know, lead characters, as you can tell with all the other movies we talk about. I'm all about that. But if you didn't have Lorraine's the only female. So I'm glad that they added another female to kind of balance that out a little bit.
I kind of find that ironic that you say that, because I think this film does pass the Bechdel test.
Yeah, I think
definitely.
So, too.
Yeah,
no, it
so
does.
Like,
and,
I don't know.
And to David Leitch...
Yeah, and I'm all for that.
You know, but to David Leitch, you know, he says LaSalle's character represents naivety and innocence that Lorraine has obviously lost, right? And then for a moment she cracks and shows humanity in a world of lies where you really can't trust anyone. and she was really important part of the story, so they just expanded it a bit. And I think they really did a good job, and again, to one more time, I apologize for being redundant, but I do think that it was a true moment for Broughton's character, or Satchel, in this, because it was, she looked upon her as maybe how she may have been at that age or time in her life when she signed on to be CIA, or I'm like, whatever it is that she is. And I think that they both played it off very well, and I didn't find it gratuitous and or exploitive. I actually, it worked for me. And in today's world, when we're talking about transgender, bi, homosexuality, having it in there, to me, just seemed run-of-the-mill. I wasn't offended by it, and I thought it was handled very, very well by both the actresses. I thought Sophia Boutella is growing to be a really solid actress.
She's great. I love the fact that there is another woman lost within this world that Lorraine could confide in.
Mm.
I was all about that.
Yeah.
Any other story elements before we move on to more of the production side of things, which I know we kind of jumped back and forth.
No, let's go into production.
Let's do it. So, I mean, in some sense, we've kind of talked a lot about the action. So, where should we jump off? I mean, there's, interestingly enough, in terms of the way they did it, there was a big connection between the way they edited it and obviously the way they were shooting, where pretty much both were kind of happening hand in hand. I believe, Marissa, these are a lot of your notes, so I'll let you jump in.
I found this really interesting. The editor, I'm sorry, I'm going to completely butcher
his name.
She's
from Iceland, and it's a girl.
The editor, you can read a rundown. But usually in production, like especially like big moves such as this, that the editor is usually not the one on set. But she was there, like, watching the dailies, and they were pretty much editing simultaneously while filming, so they can have things match, a lot of footage match, and, you know, synchronized and choreographed to the moves and stuff. So the editor had, like, already real-time on-set experience and the visualization of actually putting it together, which usually everything's filmed beforehand, and then you put it all together later. She had the real-time one-on-one during it.
Yeah, which creates a great feedback loop.
Absolutely.
When you're afforded that. So definitely worked to their advantage in that sense.
So in that scene that we're talking to, Theron mastered up 30 moves of choreography, okay, for one continuous scene that they shot again and again. And in one bit of staging, she had to slam a stunt performer playing a Broughton attacker into a collapsible wooden table. And the props and set decoration departments were kept busy replacing not only the piece of furniture, but also numerous other items. And they actually came down to their very, very last table. And they're like, ooh, we got to get this one right. It's our last table.
Well, even the table, right? It was interesting to learn that glass doesn't shatter in the way that you think. Like, most tables are made so it kind of stays compact, believe it or not. They had to, in a sense, put, not explosives, but, you know, a way to help make it shatter even more so it's visually appealing. So that was kind of new for me to learn because, movies have historically always, the glass shatters and goes everywhere.
Right, and a lot of times, for the majority of the time during filmmaking, is that whenever you see glass shattering, it's usually like sugar sheets.
Right.
And that actually breaks down and is thick enough on camera that you can see pieces disintegrating in that sense. And the cool thing about like the editing, because it was such a long sequence that went from shot to shot in different angles and stuff, that's why they had to be on set. So they made sure, once they panned the camera to this angle, it actually matched up to when they changed the actual camera angle. So that's where the synchronization and everything actually in order had to match up, and they had to be on set to make sure that happened.
Yeah, and the editing also had another challenge on their side. This I hadn't known either, but McAvoy had actually broken his arm a few weeks before filming. So I thought the cast was a prop.
They made it work.
They made it work, but from an editing standpoint, they had to block, then edit him carefully because of him breaking, you know, having his arm. And they had to capitalize on the imagery of his character sporting a cast, realizing that it spoke volumes about his recklessness. So that the cast actually became a believable prop, which you go, oh. Because I was wondering, what the hell does he have a cast on for? Is that part of
I
the
thought
character?
To hide any
which we came and showed it did.
Mice.
Hi. Yeah. But then, you know, McAvoy had his, unlike, you know, I mean, Theron had to escape injury. He narrowly escaped some serious injury during the shoot when he secured, he was secured in the driver's seat of the 80s Porsche 911. He was doing his own driving for a scene where Percival saves Broden. And on the 7th or 8th take, the handbrake didn't set, so he kept going right into the camera crew.
Oh, jeez.
Or right towards the camera crew. And he had to force the wheel and the foot brake, and finally he was able to... He was stopped by a wall. So, you know, he was a little bit shaken. But, you know, hey, what did you say? Sacrifice for art? Or what did you say earlier?
Yeah, you suffer for your art.
You suffer for your art.
It happens.
Let's, speaking of art, let's talk about, I mean, this music, this movie is littered with music. And some on the nose, like London Calling.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, they give it a good 80s feel. And so let's kind of break it down. I know, Dimitri, you had mentioned you want to talk about David Bowie in particular. So want to kick us off there?
Yeah, and again, the song Putting Out the Fire with Gasoline was the main song to Cat People, starring Natasha Kinski. And that was a big hit in the 80s, but it was a big hit from that movie soundtrack. It was the theme. It was the theme. I mean, that's echoed throughout the movie. I haven't seen it in ages, but I obviously remember that.
Never
and
seen
I
it.
Can't recall a movie ever... Well, this is a main theme to this movie, and we're going to make it a theme in this movie. What I really love, though, about the soundtrack... And I'm just trying to get back to... Well, David Bowie, cast and crew were big fans. And upon the filming, they had actually reached out to him. They wanted him because he was so iconic, particularly within this whole Berlin Wall, the coming down of the wall. They wanted him in the movie. And they actually reached out. And he was going to be probably playing the man behind the glass. He was going to be in the interrogation scene. And he had politely declined, and it wasn't that they were going to use his music, and it was some weeks into filming that he had passed, and they had played, you know, that they had their own little memorial, so to speak, for him by playing his music. But they really felt that because Bowie has had renaissances, but particularly in the 80s, where he became very big again. But this Putting Out the Fire with Gasoline is one such song. What I loved about this soundtrack, though, is above and beyond going to, what did you say, Pandora's 80s?
Yeah, Pandora's 80s station.
Yeah. Above and beyond that, though, they were playing different versions of songs that we don't normally hear on Sirius, you know, 80s on 8. Or Pandora's 80s. They were playing versions of songs that were different. So I wasn't hearing the same old licensed song of 99 Luftballons. I heard that, but then I got another version of it. That was really cool. And that's one of the things I liked about this movie. It didn't go by the rote. Let's get what we can easily license. Let's get the stuff. Let's get that same song, but let's get this version of it. That was popular.
It's recognizable enough.
Well, they did have that MTV like news announcement that sampling's taking over. I was like, oh, okay. Yeah,
that was very on the nose. I laughed at that.
That was funny. That was so funny.
It's basically plagiarism.
Yeah, it's basically. Yeah.
Interestingly enough, you know, you would think for the most part that they would kind of cut to the music, that they had the soundtrack in mind. They, you know, we talk about it with Guardians of the Galaxy, where he's very meticulous in picking out the music that will fit the script. This, you know, they didn't necessarily focus on that. Apart from the David Bowie stuff that they knew was very iconic, the rest of it was just like, we got to edit a scene. We got to make it good. And, you know, what will follow. Like, that's the normal progression of filmmaking for the most part.
Right.
And that's what they chose to do, which is actually surprising in some ways, because, you know, you take a movie like Baby Driver, that thing's choreographed to right. music.
I mean, yeah, it's as much a musical, where again, this wasn't even source music, but it was used.
It was at times with the cars and...
Yeah, but...
The trailer was the music video.
Yes, it was.
Edited to music.
And... But to me, it also helped drive this movie. Not that I'm not calling this movie a musical by any stretch, but it did help. Like, you recognize the songs. It was mm-hmm. like, oh, all right, this is a really great song. Now, in the sound system, the theater that I saw this in, the music sounded awesome. I have the soundtrack, and I played it, and it's really 80s. It's eclectic. We talk about Charlize Theron and what she can't do. I really don't know, because she was a DJ on 80s on 8, Sirius Satellite, you know, Sirius XM 80s on 8. And she, quote unquote, took over to promote Atomic Blonde. And she was a DJ. And I got to say, she was awesome as a DJ. It was great listening to her. And she got to talk about her love of 80s music. And yeah, she was fantastic. I enjoyed listening to this soundtrack as much for the songs, the versions of the songs that I knew, and for the versions of the same songs that were just different. I appreciated that.
Absolutely. So, Anthony, you have anything? You've kind of been quiet for a while. You got anything to add about music?
Well, at first, I'm not sure if I liked the whole two versions of 99 Left Balloons, and I was like joking with my friend, like they couldn't find anything else in that genre from that time frame to play. But then again, I thought about it. I was like, what was really popping in 1990s Berlin, you know, that we as Americans...
You have to go back to your repertoire.
That we as Americans can be like, oh yeah, I know that song. Like, no, it's like 99 Left Balloons and whatever else was mentioned, which personally I wasn't really too familiar with, unfortunately. But it was still fun. It was, yeah, the music was a good touch. I liked it. I really enjoyed the slow rendition of 99 Left Balloons. It was quite something.
Yeah.
I loved Under Pressure. That was great. I think that was like really, yes, you know, putting the nail on the coffin.
Yeah, that was pretty on the nose.
That was on the nose.
Like, done.
Yep.
Done.
I think a lot of their songs were definitely on the nose.
And London Calling, too, was really cool. I really enjoyed, like, again, this music didn't get in the way of things at all.
I would argue quite the opposite. I mean, thankfully it was there, because I probably would have gotten bored sooner.
Fair enough.
Fair. All right. So there you have it.
Can we talk a little bit too about another main central character in this movie? Is the Berlin Wall?
Sure.
Which actually they used Budapest to double for Berlin.
Gotta love Budapest.
Well, in Berlin,
it's the tax credits.
Everybody filmed in Budapest.
Well, you know, go figure. Berlin has changed quite a lot since 1989. So, with significant renovation and architectural additions, there's no longer the same textures. But Budapest has stunning old abandoned buildings that they could have used. And so there you go. The Hungarian capital was also dressed up to stand in for London and Paris. And some wider streets were found to effectively emulate the latter city. Mm-hmm. So go Budapest. But regarding the wall, they created a 250-foot-long, 12-foot-high, wood-based recreation of the Berlin Wall, built in several sections so it could be portable. And this cinematic version was hauled to various locations in Budapest as the backdrop. And then they hired local graffiti artists to capture the feel of the 80s and barricades in the manner similar to how citizens and visitors expressed themselves decades ago in the actual Berlin Wall. So, and if you notice on the east side, the west side did not have any of that at all. That's what's a really big deal for when that wall came down. No. Which I think is, and plus it is a Cold War spy story, so I like
that. And the visualization of that, it obviously felt very cold, felt very neon, if you will.
It was definitely saturated. Right. If it had it not been for the neon lights, the practical neon lights, it would have been a very gray, kind of monochromatic feel to it.
Sure.
And but it definitely sent that environment that is, it is a cold, kind of lifeless place. Although there's a lot of death involved, so I definitely got that tone for it, and I think it was great. I love the atomic colors, the neon.
Yeah.
I'm currently coordinated to that. This is as atomic as I'm gonna get. But I loved it. It was visually stunning. Like, even the opening shot when she's in the bathtub, it's like it's all blue. And then there, when she was in the hotel at night, it was blue and pink and purple. It's like visually pretty.
Yeah. And you're right, too. And cinematographer Jonathan Sala, and he conceived how the palette should be. And so we were muted in gray in the London scenes, but come out with more color than expected in Berlin, as you're saying, oversaturated, particularly. Well, here we go. I have everything mixed up, particularly with the West and its punk movements, to go with richness and vibrancy. Sala utilized the Alexa cameras and anamorphic lenses to capture a widescreen imagery. So frame shots of stunning, crumbling buildings that are on set, isolated narrow streets. In researching Berlin at that time, he was surprised as to just how colorful it was. And that motivated us to go to super saturation. You know, we made use of blue, yep, like you blue. Are, and pink neon, notably in the bar where Broughton and Delphine first meet. That bar, by the way, that was a fun scene. It was a great scene. So, you know, and you can see the color contrasts too, which was, you know, really well done.
Definitely, and I think the one scene that like really stood out was that final scene when she's in the hotel. That was the warmest color scene. And that's the first scene in the trailer that, you know, promotes the whole film. It's orange, it's yellow, it's warm.
Right.
It's a completely different look, because that scene isolated can definitely tell the audience that she's in a completely different location, dealing with completely different people, working on a completely different case.
And it's at the tone, too. Like you're saying, to expand, you know, the visual contrast between East and West are there not only to express the political goings-on of the time, but they also helped give us, the audience, a track or a color code to the story. Mm-hmm. Which side are we on? Like, so if you change that color code, you don't physically have to see them going to that side of the wall. You just sort of kind of, here.
No.
So very interesting for a cinematographer, and the challenges that had to go through.
I liked it, and they you can definitely tell visually, like, the different changes too, because during that whole 8-12 minute sequence that she's fighting, she clearly says the line, "I have to get back to this side."
Right.
But during that fight, it was like that was saturated, and then when she crossed the wall, like, it had a completely different feel, completely different look with the lighting, because she's back at her hotel.
Right.
Like, you can tell the two stark contrast.
Yeah, absolutely.
Loved it.
Yeah. I mean, did you like the look of the film?
I did, overall, yeah. I thought the look would look... the real pain of this movie is that there's so much good stuff. Take the characters and just make a different movie, and I'm in. Mm-hmm. You know? It just suffered by the weight of the plot and its structure, in a sense.
Well, one other character we haven't really spoke about, but it was it's a prop, but it's integral to the story, was the watch. The actual, which held the...
That'll get me so angry. Damn MacGuffin.
But that also kind of gave me that MI6 feel of James Bond. It came in his watch, and the Omega.
It's the watch, and this is another high-end type of watch, Carl F. Boucher watch timepiece, and it was provided by the company for the production. And they actually had to have a technician from that watch company from Germany to assist in the maintenance of the watch, to take it apart, put it together. I thought that that was very... I thought that that was very... Being a watch person... myself, and yes, I am Omega as opposed to Carl F. Boucher, but I just found that that was interesting. The bar sequence that we talked about, a rough trade bar sequence, believe it or not, it was filmed at a defunct Budapest cabaret, and you'll like this, you'll appreciate this. It was modeled after the famed Moulin Rouge.
I love Moulin Rouge. I literally watched that movie on Saturday again. So good.
I'm sorry, and your head's still on you. Didn't explode.
I love that film. What are you talking about? All right, moving on. I digress.
That's funny.
All good. So let's talk pure numbers here. Overall,
I was actually surprised with the fairly low budget that this film was. It was only 30 million.
Million. That's because 80 million went to advertising.
Yeah, that's
it was everywhere.
I think they did a great job, but
by the way, I don't know if 80 million is actually the number of the budget for the advertising, but it was just everywhere.
It could be. I mean, because that's an extra 50 when you're thinking about it. So, I mean, if your production budget is 30, 50 is nothing. And it was, I mean, out here in L.A., sometimes I just wonder, we're in Los Angeles here, so we see a lot of movie advertising. And a lot of it out here too is set up by ego. I mean, there's certain reasons why certain billboards will have a particular piece of advertising is because they know a certain exec will drive by that every day, every morning, and every going home, and so it's strategically placed. But we see a lot of movie advertising here, whether it be billboard, bus, or whatever. Someplace out in the Midwest isn't going to see it as much.
Oh,
so
heck,
I just
no.
wonder.
I don't know. And I'll say that because okay. I was just in the Midwest. I didn't see any advertisements for this film.
Yeah.
I only saw it on television out here in California. Mm-hmm. So it's very,
you saw
very
nothing
true.
On,
it's
you,
very true.
You didn't see anything on TV back home?
No. And there's no billboards or like actual the media promotion that it's so heavily featured out here was nowhere in the Midwest.
Yeah. And It currently, as of August 3rd, right, 25 million, 25.8. Here's the thing. It came, its opening weekend, it did 18 million. It came in at number four. 3,300 plus locations, which is a pretty decent release. Focus Features falls under the umbrella of Universal, but they have their own distribution wing. They advertised the hell out of it, at least from what we saw. You know, but I'm going to say this. I like the movie better than you fine folk, and that's. But the conversation I think has been fantastic. This is what I love, and people who will get in on the discussion. I like this. This is fantastic. Me thinking that this is a really good movie, and me believing that Charlize Theron, who produced this movie, who starred and acted in this movie, right? It didn't get enough of that. We're in this world where we're trying to promote more women getting better, beefier roles, right? Mm-hmm. And here's a prime example of a movie, in my opinion, that didn't suck. I know its reception on Rotten Tomatoes was, I believe, a 75.
Yeah, with a B minus for cinema score.
With a B minus in cinema score. I'll go back. I think that was a little bit marketing bait and switch. But still, 75% isn't awful, okay? Where are the women? Like, you know, Patty Jenkins, I follow on Twitter, and we talked overhype last week, right? And some people took me to task and said, well, what about Wonder Woman? And Wonder Woman, when it came out, I'm a big fan of the movie. I think it's the best DC movie. And there was a lot of talk because of a female director, because of a female protagonist. And it's reached some amazing milestones, which I congratulated for. And I was hoping that that's going to open up the door. But I'm at the point where I'm tired of hearing about Wonder Woman, considering that we've had other women movies out there. Megan Levy being one of them. You and
oh,
I talked
I
about
love it. I still talk about Megan Levy. 33 days to DVD. Just
how
now.
Much publicity did that movie get for being the
None.
Good movie that it was?
None.
Zero. This movie, not so much. Like, Patty Jenkins, didn't she direct Monster? And again, maybe I missed it because I'm not always on Twitter, so maybe. But wouldn't it have behooved Patty Jenkins, like, yay, Wonder Woman's great. Hey, my good friend Charlize produced a movie and she's kick-ass in it. You gotta promote it, and you gotta go to these movies. Like, if you don't, like, they can't just be superhero movies. And I'm glad Ladies Night Out has done a modicum of good business, too.
Girls' Night.
Girls' Night. Trip. Girls' Trip. Sorry, girls' Trip. Girls'
Rough
Trip.
Night.
But that was a comedy. And, you know, and that's gotten a modicum of publicity and press, but nowhere near what it should be getting. This movie, nowhere near what it should be getting. If you want this equality, you've got to fight for it. You've got to go out there. I fight for it. I think it's amazing. She produced this movie because she felt it was great for the woman role. For there. And she wasn't. She passes that Bechdel test.
Bechdel.
You've got to get... You have to support these movies. If you want more of them, and they don't just have to be superheroines. I mean, she's a kick-ass spy. And whether or not there's additional Laura Broughton movies depends on you going. And coming in fourth doesn't necessarily convince a studio
speaks volumes
that we're going to make another movie. And yet, this movie wasn't awful. I've seen awful movies. But this movie championed the woman. It championed the woman experience, and it was headed by a woman. May not be have been directed by, but Charlize was clearly the driving force, and she chose to act in it because she loved that this character was strong and smart, and she could remain sexy, too. Yeah. That, to me, is important. And if we really want to do this rally cry, and we really want more women in film to play bigger roles... You've got to support the ones that are out there doing it and working hard to bring that to fruition. So, yes, enough about Wonder Woman. Focus on Atomic Blonde a little. Maybe you don't like it as much as Wonder Woman. You can't take your child to Atomic Blonde. I get it. But Girls Trip was rated R2. It's a raunchy comedy. Focus on making these women movies popular, and then Hollywood is going to get it in their heads to put more women in film. I'm going to get off my soapbox now.
Fair enough. I will say this. Yes, hand clap. Thank you, Marissa. You know, it's tough for me because I'm not in love with this movie. However, I would love to see a better version. You know, I'm down for a sequel. You know, I am. I love the characters. I think there's a whole world to really explore. I think the language is exciting. I just don't think they finessed it enough for what this was, and so I would have loved to see a better first effort, but I'm willing to give it a second.
I got the sequel title already.
Yeah, what's that?
Fate of the Furious?
No, it's going to be Nuclear Bomb.
Good one. And yeah,
it could be Atomic Brunette. Who cares? I think what I...
She looked awesome as a brunette.
She did. She was awesome. what I liked about this film, the characters were great. Arguably so. Like, Lorraine, she was awesome. You were rooting for her the entire time. Charlize, her acting was phenomenal, despite her British accent. But yeah. Once you get over that, like, you can actually... This is a performance you can watch and enjoy. I think this film suffers for the story development. Okay. And that's where it brings the average of this film down. Not because of the performance and how it was actually shown visually and how it was executed, but because of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have to completely agree with you. The performances were on point. I think the film overall does get hurt by the story and how it's structured. I just want to say, like, one of my favorite parts of the film was James McAvoy's character. And also Charlize Theron's fight scenes, which I thought were really great. Also, I was thinking about it. This one idea, I don't know if it's right or not. I'll bounce it off you guys. It's could this movie, in a way, serve as an allegory for women in film fighting their way through the crowds of men to be able to establish their own identity in this film world? But in this sense, it's like she's trying to keep her identity secret. But in this film, she's like going through crowds. She's busting through men.
Listen, I'm not gonna disagree with you.
Check out the brain on Brett.
Yeah. But I'm not gonna go and defend that.
It definitely could be, and I think also the fact that the story is actually placed in a historic time might be another thing why it's getting maybe lost within the shuffle of everything else.
Yeah, it could be.
But yes, I completely agree with the allegory. It is reflective of now's day. Now, today, the women are still fighting to get positions and opportunities within this industry, within, you know, having proper screen time and everything. So, yeah, absolutely.
I think so. And we also forgot, she was the main villain in the last Fast and Furious movie.
Well, that's why I'm jokingly saying that's the sequel.
Yeah. And she was a great villain in that movie. I'm just saying, for a movie that's not miserable, that's not in the 20 percentiles, that doesn't demean women, I don't know, just throw some support. I think Charlize Theron picked a good project. I enjoyed I understand. I enjoyed it more than everyone else. I think it's a good, solid film. Those are my final thoughts.
I'd watch the sequel.
Yeah, I enjoyed it, too.
I would watch Dimitri, the sequel, too.
All righty. Well, we stand somewhere in the middle, but we surely stand nonetheless to support women. So there you have it.
Are you 75% or are you lower than the 75 or 73, whatever it is in Rotten Tomatoes?
I don't know. It's which
I would give 40. It around there because of the story.
I'd give it a solid 75, yeah.
And next week, I've already got my soapbox for Rotten Tomatoes and such, but yeah, I'm a little bit higher. But hey, wait, did you say lower than 75?
I said 40.
Wow.
40? I didn't love this movie.
Okay, fair enough. Okay.
Sorry. A lot of good stuff. Make a sequel. Make it good. I'm in. Just this one.
Yeah, better story. Better story.
All right, better ladies story. And gentlemen. Thank you guys as always at Serafini TV.
That's right.
We'll continue to be ironic. We'll continue to be ironically told about.
Yep.
At D Movies 1701.
Thanks. Support me, please.
What the hell is your Twitter, Anthony?
It's actually absurdpanda1002.
Who the hell's gonna remember that?
Right.
Absurdpanda1002. Yeah, I don't have a lower third for myself, but
all right. At Movie Anatomy, at The Popcorn Talk. Check out past episodes we've done. We've covered a lot of Charlize Theron movies, including Fate of the Furious, and a lot of I saw Tinker. Taylor Soldier Spy, but I forget if we did that.
I think that was well before our time.
Got it. That's a bummer. That was a good movie. But we've done spy movies in the past. We've done
absolutely.
Other movies,
done
action John movies, Wick. John Wick, sure. Certainly. And we've got a lot to look forward to. Next week, we've got The Dark Tower and some movie that I'm forgetting.
Detroit.
Speaking of
Catherine Bigelow.
Another historical.
Yes.
That's going to be an interesting one.
So definitely check us out for that and tons and tons of movies down the line as well. So keep checking back in. See you guys next time.
Bye.
And the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff. We would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.